Chapter 9. Christmas Town. Squarely in the middle of the Canadian map, the province of Manitoba covers an area about the size of Texas. Yet in 65, the population amounted to under a million, roughly half in the capital city of Winnipeg. Demographically, Manitoba looked like a big linoleum floor on which someone had dropped an ice cream cone. One massive lump and some splatters. Brandon was the largest splatter. Brandon sits in a large valley dug by the Assiniboine River in an otherwise featureless plain, 3.5 hours east from Regina, 2 hours drive west of Winnipeg. It's a relief, if you actually find it on the way west. Fail to turn left on the Trans-Canada, and Brandon is experienced as 4 gas stations, 2 motels, a campground, and the gateway to another 600 miles of flat. Memories of our family's 5 years in Regina would take on the quasi-mystical quality that goes with the remembered landscapes of the very young. But Brandon would become my true hometown. The street grid, the little stores, and crosstown neighborhoods, the surrounding fields, would be Brandon on my brain all the way down to the subconscious. The town still provides the geography of my dreams. Decades and several home bases later, I usually wake up to find that whatever REM scenarios I've just been experiencing were set somewhere on the streets of Brandon. Our wandering years were over. We had arrived in Christmas Town. Not that it felt like that to a 7-year-old. Brandon was new territory, with new rules to be learned. The novelty extended even to Christmas itself. Not long after the move, the holiday time shifted, at least the part of the holiday that is the entire point of the thing when you're 7. Christmas morning gift-opening celebrations are a necessity when kids are still loaded with the Christmas 1.0 software, the version where your roof is still a runway and the chimney a legitimate point of entry. At that age, Christmas Eve is reserved for lying in bunk beds, vibrating like tuning forks, and discussing doctrinal issues. Can the likes of Prancer and Cupid really match the lightning speed and surprise of Blitzen? Now that we know of the existence of Rudolph, could there be other mutant reindeer that we haven't been told about? Why do you even need a Rudolph when you already have a Comet? Is it enough to simply be good, or will Santa grade on the curve? Is it possible to be so good that you get everything? But in our family, that innocent era was over relatively early. A group of 5 kids generates an efficient grapevine, and the smallest eat from the tree of knowledge prematurely. So my Santa died young. By age 5, I had already inadvertently ruined a young neighbor's life by blurting out the truth. "But Santa's not real," I told Linda Yakubovich helpfully. Her face folded up like a collapsing bag releasing a ball of anguish. "I'm sorry, Linda. I didn't realize." By the time we reached Brandon, it was clear no more Yuletide subterfuge was needed. And since a United Church minister tends to be rather busy Christmas Day, it was decided with only a modest amount of reluctant whining that from now on, the Burgess Christmas would be celebrated on Christmas Eve, so Dad could join in. The new routine hardened quickly, as these things do. Christmas Eve, Dad would take his place in the rocking chair, never a moment too soon, and surrounded by the impatient, proceed to read out the gift tags one by one. Until one gift was opened and cooed over, the next gift would wait. And all on Christmas Eve, no less. We thought ourselves rebels. Our Christmases were reliably white. So were our marches, which was less enchanting. Years later, when I was working in a northern Manitoba town, a co-worker and several drunken friends went for a drive into the countryside, none of them wearing proper outerwear. They got a flat tire. My co-worker, and all but one of his friends, died. In a Manitoba winter, particularly during that pre-cell phone era, car trouble could be fatal. But summers were shimmering hot and perfumed with the warm scent of prairie grass and railroad tar. There were open fields where you could build forts and smoke stolen cigarettes. Whether it was the size of the town or the innocence of the age, we ran about with a freedom that nowadays might lead to an investigation by social services. Kids would play hide-and-seek and kick the can in the early evening. Far more dangerous pursuits in those days. Abandoned refrigerators were death traps. There must have been a few small-town hide-and-seek games where quiet little Tommy never did turn up, and the kids just gave up and went home. We never lost anybody as far as I recall, but then we didn't do head counts either. Mid-60s Brandon was home to about 30,000 people. There were two TV channels. People curled. They knew that cash spiel could be written as one word or two. Brandon was a farm town in more ways than one. It served as a retail center for the surrounding rural community, the place to shop for flour, frozen vegetables, maybe even a new combine. And Brandon's schools turned out crops of young hopefuls, destined to spread out around the continent. A medium-sized town with decent schools will always churn out more graduates than it can support. For those with ambition, a Brandon education was like a minor league contract. And naturally, we had the hockey version, too, at a big, atmospheric old barn in the middle of town, where you could watch the Brandon Wheat Kings major junior team. Any list of notable Brandon citizens will almost certainly include at least four names. Hall of Famer Turk Broda, Flyers great Ron Hextall, Oilers Stanley Cup winner Bill Ranford, and Canucks stopper Glenn Hanlon. National Hockey League goaltenders have been the city's most prominent export. That aspect of the local culture did not play to my strengths. I couldn't skate. In Manitoba, that was like being Rudolph before the fog rolled in. When they strapped skates on me, the blades went sideways and I sort of walked on my ankles. It wasn't pretty. I had to learn to tell jokes. It wasn't all hockey, thank God. There was a movie theater. Two, if you counted the drive-in. The selection of films was limited, perhaps, but if you were a kid, it guaranteed you'd occasionally get to see something interesting. When it was someone's birthday, you generally went to the movies, and that meant you saw whatever was on. One year on Leslie's birthday, it was The Sand Pebbles. It ends with Steve McQueen being shot to death by unseen Chinese snipers. Leslie couldn't stop crying. Another time, Mom and Dad took us to the drive-in to see something like Mary Poppins or Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, but the first half of the double bill turned out to be an arty French vampire flick called Blood and Roses, directed by Roger Vadim and starring his post-Brigitte Bardot and pre-Jane Fonda wife, Annette. An obsessed lover believes she is the reincarnation of an ancient vampire and sees herself covered in blood each time she looks in the mirror. In the end, she falls off a cliff and is impaled on a bloody stake. Mom and Dad made us face the back of the car until Julie Andrews or Dick Van Dyke appeared, but we all got glimpses and sort of pieced it together later. Brandon was no culinary mecca. It was more of a culinary Kiev. Thanks to the significant local Ukrainian population, church socials and potluck dinners often featured pierogies, cabbage rolls, and borscht. Yet somehow, you could never find that great cuisine in a restaurant. British immigrants still dominated, and that sealed our fate as far as restaurant fare went. Or perhaps it is just the cuisine of small towns then and now. Chicken or egg salad, Denver sandwiches, fries, and hamburgers that no travel guide would ever describe as undiscovered treasures. At Brandon Diners, the myth of small-town quality ran up against fly-specked reality. Ethnic food? Sue's Chop Suey House. Later on, the exciting 70s would bring in a few pizza joints. Two of them were chains, but one had real Italians. Downtown was still the place to shop at street-corner department stores like the Metropolitan, Kresge's, and especially Eaton's. It was the golden age for a lot of waddling retail dodos, blissfully unaware that someday the predators would come. A few of my school friends and I would spend our after-school time downtown shoplifting useless items for the sake of theft. I once stole a plastic Santa in July. As we wandered the aisles of the Met, floorwalkers would trail us doggedly. Considering the ultimate fate of the Met and the entire downtown retail environment, those grim-faced employees should probably have been out hunting Sam Walton. The Wheat City had one institution that set it apart from the average prairie town. Brandon University was smaller than Winnipeg's two post-secondary institutions, albeit with a music department that punched above its weight. Later alumni include violin prodigy James Ennis. But the school's most famous alumnus graduated in 1930, back when it was known as Brandon College. Socialist icon Tommy Douglas, named the greatest Canadian of all time in a 2004 CBC national poll, left Brandon College with a master's degree in sociology. It is said that Douglas and Stanley Knowles, another future giant of Canadian socialist politics, had a particular technique for redistributing wealth. Douglas would offer to bet anyone that Knowles could read through a student essay twice and recite it by heart. The young and relatively well-heeled would then learn to their cost that Knowles possessed a photographic memory. Douglas absorbed liberal theology from Brandon College professors who inveighed against fundamentalism and promoted the gospel of social justice. 40 years later, Bill Burgess set up shop across the street at Knox United, ready to take up the same banner. Since its founding in 1925, the United Church of Canada has been a home for social activists. But as Canada's largest Protestant denomination, it naturally came to include believers of almost every theological stripe. The Knox congregation was thus an uneasy mix of liberal and conservative traditions, and in that regard, it was Brandon writ small. The presence of the university ensured that Brandon would have its coterie of liberals, but we were not quite Austin, Texas, a leftist fortress surrounded by ideological hostiles. Brandon was a solid bastion for the Federal Progressive Conservative Party. The personification of that political dominance was Walter Dinsdale, the local PC Member of Parliament. Dinsdale was not a flashy sort, but those who challenged him would soon discover that he hadn't gotten a vice grip on the riding by accident. At the provincial level, the little city's split personality started to show. The east side of town elected a new Democratic Party member just as regularly as the Westsiders went Tory. We Burgesses were Westsiders, but not legitimately. Dad's job paid $10,000 a year. Our first 5 years in town, we lived in the church-owned manse on a street called Cedar Bay. Doctors lived on either side. There was a swimming pool next door. In terms of relative income, our family might just as well have pulled up in a big trailer and plugged into the neighbor's utilities with a hose and a long extension cord. We all had well-off playmates. Once I slept over at a buddy's place, and in the morning, his mom served waffles with strawberries and aerosol whipped cream. It was like science fiction. The owner of Brandon's only local TV station lived around the bay. His kids had G.I. Joes and all the top-of-the-line toys, and there was a Buick Wildcat parked in the garage. Their mom didn't really look like a mom. Lynn recalls visiting the home of her friend down the street. She had a pool table in her beautifully finished basement. Their house didn't just have an upstairs and a downstairs, it had levels. They had wall-to-wall carpeting, back when that was something you wanted. She never had to worry either about whether she had enough outfits to make it through the week without repeating. And there was the neighbor's swimming pool. My sister spied on it, wrapped as two supermodels outside a bakery. Had our backstroking neighbors ever lifted their gaze beyond the fence and toward the upper windows of our house, they would have screamed in terror, glowing faintly in the dark were the unblinking orbs of green-eyed monsters. I still remember Leslie and I standing on her bed by the window, Lynn says, looking out at the pool and hearing that sound of the diving board as one of them dove in. Looking to the sky, a bathing suit clutched tightly in her fist, Lynn made a solemn vow. "As God is my witness," she cried, "I'll never be poolless again." Or so I assume. But while Lynn had to play Scarlett O'Hara, I was free to be Huck Finn. Envy is not such a big issue for 8-year-old boys. G.I. Joes and strawberry waffles notwithstanding, I had as many marbles as the next kid. As far as pools were concerned, Jock and I were men of action. One day we dug a massive hole in the backyard and filled it with water. It lacked certain amenities, such as filtration and visibility, but it had something better. Frogs. We caught over a dozen in a nearby ravine and brought them to their new home, a paradise of amphibian community planning. Like so many socially engineered utopias, it would all go horribly wrong. Even before Mum demanded that we replace every shovelful of dirt, our tenants had vacated. We learned this one Sunday on the way home from church. Approaching our street, we saw at least a dozen flat, spotted discs of frog leather scattered over the road. Where they were headed, we would never know. At any rate, none of the neighbors had stopped for them. We all crossed the road more carefully after that. Frogs are not enough for everyone. As the eldest two, Joe and Lynn had a keen sense of our relative economic position. Plus, Lynn and Les were girls, with all that entailed. Lynn in particular felt that lack of status. I remember Mum trying to explain to me why we didn't have money for something I wanted, trying to explain that we were struggling a bit financially. I screamed at her, "Don't tell me about that stuff! I don't want to know about that!" We were not poor. In fact, Mum and Dad had managed to scrape together $5,000 in savings to buy a cottage at Clear Lake, 70 miles north of Brandon, a summer spot destined to become hallowed ground for the Burgess clan. But on a day-to-day basis, we operated very close to the bone. In a professional neighborhood, our home was a lower-middle-class quarantine. Hamburger seemed like a luxury. We ate a lot of puffed wheat. Mum mixed powdered milk with the real stuff. Any fresh fruit was carefully rationed. I got a lot of hand-me-downs, and Mum cut all our hair. Living on a street full of doctors had some benefits, at least on those occasions when we kids tried to kill ourselves. Nobody tried harder than me. The accident that came closest to killing me was Jock's fault, mostly. One night at dinner, he suggested I was clumsy. It was a vile slander that had to be answered. After dinner, I walked across the street to the big construction site at Vincent Massey School. They were building a new wing with a big gymnasium and more classrooms. The site was not fenced off. Before the modern culture of litigation took hold, construction sites were playgrounds for young boys, obstacle courses, full-size Stalingrad sets for urban war games. I wandered in and started exploring. In one roofless room, a diagonal row of reinforcing rods climbed the wall like a treehouse staircase. Clumsy, am I? I scrambled to the top of the wall and began to walk along its narrow length. Below me, double rows of rebars stuck up from the unfinished floor like bamboo stakes in a booby-trapped pit. At the intersection of two walls, a large wooden board was propped up. I steadied myself on the board and reached my foot into space, intending to step on another metal bar. The board I leaned on had not been nailed down and toppled over. I wavered, wobbled, and pitched forward into space. It seemed to me that I was going down head first. In fact, it was my feet that touched concrete first, my knees a millisecond later. A week or so later, I would notice that my bruised and bloodied knees hurt like hell. But it would take that long for those particular nerves to be heard above the sensory din. I had bigger problems higher up. A piece of rebar had struck me just below my mouth, splitting my lip and thrusting deep into my cheek. Doctors would later say that the placement was almost surgical. An inch higher would have cost me an eye or pierced my brain. An inch or two lower would have severed my jugular vein. As it was, I was merely bleeding like the runner-up in a saber duel. My hand jerked to my mouth. It came back dripping. I screamed, and it seemed to me that the noise of all the nearby Little League games suddenly ceased. I lurched up and out of the room. There was an obstacle in front of me, a little wooden divider, no more than a foot and a half high. I slumped down in front of it, momentarily defeated. Later it would be explained to me that this temporary helplessness was probably the result of shock. I sat staring at that little wall for what seemed like quite a while, steadily losing more blood, before I could summon the appropriate urgency. Then I was up again, over the obstacle, through the maze of unfinished rooms, and out to the street. My path must have been marked by a dribbling red trail, like little Jeffy in a slasher movie version of the Family Circus. We had, as I mentioned, doctors on both sides. Our doctor neighbor to the north was not a family pal. His wife had threatened legal action if Burgess kids kept throwing crabapple cores into their yard. On this evening, he was out mowing the lawn and saw me staggering across the road holding my face. He raced out to meet me, pried my hands away, and quickly surveyed the damage. As he bundled me toward our front door, he called out to my parents to start the car. "I knew something was wrong," Jock said later, "when I came home and noticed that the green face cloth in the bathroom was now red." Dad ran red lights as we raced to the hospital. I recall touching my face and wondering what that unfamiliar mass of chaotic flesh could possibly look like. In the operating room, they pulled a sheet over me as though I were a cadaver. It contained one cutout square positioned over the wound. Later, Mum said her clearest memory was of the surgeons talking to me beforehand. "We can give you the kind of anesthetic that will knock you out, Steve, but but it would be better for us if we don't. Go with a local, I said. Mum says she choked up a bit about that. They stitched me up, but more trouble was coming. The metal bar that impaled my face had been rusty and generally unfit for human consumption. Soon I was running a fever. My cheeks swelled up like a helium balloon. My teeth pulled shut. My skin became so tight and shiny, you could actually see your reflection. Naturally, Lynn would stop by the couch and use my cheek to apply her lipstick. Jock told me jokes to hear me try to laugh without being able to open my mouth. I lived on A&W milkshakes, which was great, except the straws were too fat to fit through my clenched teeth. We didn't sue. Mum didn't believe in that approach. But she had a few words with an embarrassed school board. Fences and locked gates soon closed up the construction site. I was out of school for weeks. The day I returned, an excited classmate ran up. "Where'd they shoot you?" My other near-death experience was considerably more amusing. It happened after a family trip to Dairy Queen. Each kid would get to choose one item, and Dad would buy a bag of Dilly Bars for the freezer. My habitual choice was a miraculous bit of ice cream engineering called a jet, or as we called it, a push-up. It was a little cardboard tube of ice cream equipped with a stick that pushed up the bottom as you went along. For my money, it provided a more interactive experience than a simple cone. The drive itself was a big part of it all. We'd load up with ice cream and just cruise around town, three in the front, four in the back. Even if seatbelts had been standard equipment back then, there wouldn't have been nearly enough of them. On long highway drives in those big old station wagons, we were completely untethered, bouncing around like golf balls in a dryer. On this excursion, I was wedged in at the end of the back seat row, working that jet. Dad had driven out near the edge of town where cars start to speed up on their way out to Highway 1. As he turned left off 1A, the side door swung open. I was pitched out, skidding down the asphalt on my face. I am told that there was a vehicle coming toward me at considerable speed. I never saw it. As soon as I stopped skidding, I was on my feet, running toward the ditch. It wasn't a matter of self-preservation. I was chasing my jet. It had rolled into the gravel, taking a considerable portion of chocolatey goodness with it, and my eyes were on the prize. The vehicle passed safely behind as I snatched the jet out of the dirt. Then the road rash kicked in, and I started to cry. If a frozen treat saved my life, it's not so surprising. Those Dairy Queen trips were big events. Discretionary spending was tight, and allowances minuscule. A push-up or a dipped cone was a solid recreational benefit. What passed for luxury in our house would never be recognized as such elsewhere in our street. Our parents were concerned that we not feel self-conscious about our relatively low financial status. And while we may not have kept up with the Joneses, we didn't stand out for the wrong reasons either. We weren't short of Christmas gifts. When I prayed fervently for Hot Wheels to whatever deity ruled Christmas, a kid's theology can be fuzzy on that point, Mum and Dad were there on Christmas Eve to say, "Amen." Besides, when it comes to finances, what matters psychologically is progress. An increase of allowance from 10 cents to 15 means big forward momentum. Slipping backward is the hard part. In fact, it turns out our little church ghetto might have put us in the perfect situation. A 2008 study out of Germany looked at economic satisfaction in small neighborhoods and concluded, not only do individuals feel better off as their own income grows, they also feel better as they live with richer neighbors. So maybe we were getting a little splash from that swimming pool after all. And things were indeed on the upswing. Mum had started working. Chapter 10, Spoon und Drang. Mum never smoked, and she was certainly not the impressionable sort. So I never heard her express any opinion about Virginia Slim's cigarettes or their insidiously brilliant advertising campaign. Philip Morris launched the brand in 1968 as a longer, slimmer cigarette that would presumably look a little more elegant than whatever Frank Sinatra had hanging off his lip. Ostensibly, the Virginia Slim's advertising slogan referenced the fact that it used to be illegal for women to smoke in public. But if ad men used the word zeitgeist in 1968, then somebody must have dropped it in the boardroom when they unveiled the catchphrase, You've come a long way, baby. The evil bastards were onto something. Those ads featured gowned and bejeweled models with knowing smiles and no evidence of any childbearing history. Yet strict truth in advertising regulations would have required Philip Morris to put my mother in those pictures. If you wanted to see the rising curve of female empowerment in the 1960s, you couldn't do better than hitch a ride with Joan Burgess. She was on the move. In 1964, Mum had been in full domestic lockdown, herding 5 prepubescent kids with little assistance. By 1974, Mum had completed her degree and was well into a teaching career, one that had already steered her family through a serious professional and financial crisis, an impressive but far from painless progression. There are moments in the history of nations and of people when everything changes, attacks and disasters usually. But even in the absence of some specific tragedy, there's a tendency to look for a turning point. Choosing one catalytic moment in life is not always realistic. For the sake of a more dramatic narrative, long months and years of incremental change are reduced to an incident. It had always seemed to me that there had been just such a moment in our home. It was the wooden spoon incident. This was the only time I can remember when we kids got a taste of how some others live, a brief visit to the nightmare world where children are hardened by fear and perpetual wariness. It happened at Cedar Bay. By this time, Mum had already taken her first job, secretary at Great West Life Insurance, at a salary of $55 a week. The job was more a matter of pressing financial need than a step on the road to female emancipation, but it did inadvertently prove to Mum that crisis and drama were not confined solely to the domestic realm. One day, her boss did not show up for work. Customers were calling to complain about lapsed policies. Forced to search his desk for the appropriate files, Mum found piles of undeposited checks, thousands of dollars worth of policyholder payments, simply stuck into a drawer by a man who was either experiencing a mental breakdown or had misunderstood a fundamental principle of banking. Mum helped clean up after that mess, but she had her own storms brewing. Family memories are almost always Rashomon stories. Everyone remembers things a little differently. Dad now recalls the wooden spoon incident as basically his fault, the aftermath of some marital argument that spilled over to affect the children. But from the kids' point of view, it's always about the kids. In this case, Lynn. In 1966, Lynn was a hellcat. 12 years old, stubborn, openly defiant, possessed of a wide streak of grandma. She would have been the equivalent of an attic full of squirrels even as an only child, never mind one of a quintet. Lynn sassed back and refused direct orders. And yet the trigger this time was trivial, the proverbial last straw. I had left my school books on the stairs going up, Lynn says. Mum screamed at me to take my books upstairs like I was supposed to. I recall, although who knows what's accurate anymore, that she threw the books at me. Not in a way that would cause injury, just to make the point. I must have yelled back or something. Mum went into the kitchen, grabbed a wooden spoon, and headed upstairs. Lynn sat sulking in her bedroom, at this point a familiar drill, but Lynn's usual bravado evaporated suddenly. She found herself face to face with a level of rage that was new and terrifying. Mum was sparking and crackling like a toaster in a bathtub. She turned Lynn over her knee and brought the spoon down again and again. Then the situation escalated. With Lynn howling upstairs and the kids scrambling for hiding places, Dad interceded. To the astonishment of all, he took the spoon away from Mum, swung it against her backside. "See how you like it," he said. I retreated to the basement and tried to stuff myself under the couch. Upstairs, the gods waged war. Dad was our champion. I was afraid of my mother. Many times in the past I knew I'd stepped over the line and was facing justice, and there must have also been times when I sensed it was just a good day to stay out of the way. This was a different feeling. Mum was transformed. She made it partway down the stairs before Dad coaxed her back. "You think this is over," she said, shaking a finger at us. "It isn't." But it was. She drove away and left us in the house, not returning until the kids were in bed hours later. The wooden spoon incident had been an explosion of anger from a woman proud of her self-discipline. She was out of control, Lynn says, and she wasn't known to be out of control. We could be unruly kids, certainly, but until that episode, we had not really grasped that we were playing with matches at a gas station. Mum did, though. The combustible elements had been there for years. Here was a woman of keen intelligence who had met her future husband at Queen's University, a woman whose curiosity and desire for intellectual and spiritual connection had been largely sidelined by her primary role as manager of a human puppy mill. With a manipulative, critical, emotionally domineering mother still looming over her world, and a well-meaning husband who simply wasn't grasping the situation, Joan Burgess struggled with anger, guilt, and a powerful sense of her own inadequacy, exacerbated by the experience of raising 5 young children. The fact that the other domestic wizards she watched with envy were dealing with a fraction of her workload did not seem to penetrate. She believed she was failing as a mother. "Those were our roughest days," Dad said later. The rest of us rarely understood what forces were roiling inside our mother's psyche, which is the way Mum wanted it. No one else was to be made to suffer for problems that she considered her own. As usual, Mum's course of action would be the one her own mother would never have chosen. Ruthless self-examination. Mum made the decision to see a psychiatrist. Brandon Mental Health Center opened in 1891 as the Asylum for the Insane. A campus of red brick dorms, its location on the northern shoulder of the river valley made it the embodiment of that schoolyard term, the house on the hill. Whereas the Funny Farm, an agricultural research facility called the Brandon Experimental Farm, was located just down the slope. The Brandon Mental, as we called it, perched above the city like the home of Norman Bates. Psychiatric analysis may never be an experience that people list on resumes, but in the mid-60s, the stigma was particularly powerful. It must have taken courage to climb that hill. When Dad suggested to our neighbor, the doctor with the swimming pool, that he was thinking of following Mum's lead and going for some psychiatric counseling himself, the doctor was against it. He didn't want word getting out that the minister at his church was seeing a psychiatrist, Dad recalls. I remember driving up there and hoping no one would see me. Mum had demons. But Lynn believes it was Dad who had to change the most. The direct results of Mum's psychiatric visits were not particularly helpful. Over the years, Mum would have criminally bad luck with doctors. As she described it later, her psychiatrist refused to look her in the eye during their sessions, which concluded with the doc tossing out a prescription for pills that she never took. "After a couple of visits," Mum said, "I felt like I should keep going back for his sake. I felt bad for him." Brandon being a fairly small place, I would later become good friends with several of that psychiatrist's sons. One of the older brothers was my classmate in grade 10. I was 15. He was 22. A study of that family's home life could have been some sociologist's ticket to lasting fame. The clan matriarch, an erratic Englishwoman who spoke fondly of hanging out with Joe Cocker back in the old country, would sit in the living room with a glass of hard liquor and the TV turned up full blast, to drown out the family rock band practicing at concert volume in the basement. Dr. Dad sat in the kitchen with his head in the newspaper, while family members screamed at each other, not necessarily because they were fighting, but just to be heard over the tarmac-level noise. Pot and cigarette smoke swirled overhead, and mixed drinks were a recurring design motif. They owned a large dog that habitually knocked over lamps. An hour spent in that house seemed like some kind of astronaut stress test. A favorite family anecdote I heard involved one of the brothers who, as a tyke, stole Mum's bag of pot and sold it on the street, but only charged a dollar. Kids. And supporting the family was Dr. V, the psychiatrist. Clearly he didn't bring his work home with him. Yet it must also be said that this family, as far as I could see, was close, mutually supportive, and happier than most. Once again, Tolstoy's theory of happy families blows. In spite of our neighbor's concerns, my father decided to suck it up, climb that spooky hill up to Norman Bates' house, and go see a shrink. "I was so embarrassed walking up those steps," he says. Dad's concerns quickly vanished. He and the psychiatrist, a Dr. B, established a great rapport, Eventually, Dad would return for several sessions. What exactly they discussed is lost now, but it seems the Doc was among those bold pioneers out there on the frontiers in the mid-60s mind. Dr. B was a wonderful guy, Dad says. At our last session, he gave me a book, sort of a gentle way to say that our time together was over. The book was Psychedelic Prayers and Other Meditations by Timothy Leary. Only a few years later, Dr. B would be found dead in his basement, where he had set up a private rifle range. It was a self-inflicted gunshot wound. Of course, there was always the chance that it had been an accident. Both my parents continued on the paths of self-examination via the available means of the era. That meant a lot of encounter groups. Like brown and orange color schemes and harvest gold bathroom appliances, encounter groups are now indelibly linked with the 70s. But it was during the 60s that they really started to proliferate. Encounter groups were a kind of non-traditional psychotherapy in which people discussed their feelings and uncovered deep-seated emotions. They could prove useful. They could also turn into a nasty kind of amateur hour. Generally, encounter groups were run not by psychologists, but by lay people. Later permutations included all-nude groups, 24-hour marathon sessions, and a particularly ugly variant in which one participant was singled out and attacked. Even in the gentler sessions, participants would engage in hard questioning of other attendees' responses or perceived evasions, situations that held the potential for some vicious bullying. One day in 1968, Dad was participating in a group being run by a personal friend. It would still prove traumatic. The night before, Dad reported to the group, he'd had a disturbing dream. He was enraged, chasing someone who'd done him wrong. There was murder in his heart. The man he pursued was some sort of authority figure. Who? The group leader asked. I don't know, Dad answered. I can't see. The moderator badgered. Who is it? Come on, Bill. It's my father, he said finally. It was a shock to say it. His father had been a kind and good man. But little Billy had lost his mother at age 7. Taken away in an ambulance, never to be seen again alive or dead. No chance for a 7-year-old boy to say goodbye. Someone has to be held responsible for that. Now Dad found himself crying uncontrollably. An emotional gusher had been tapped. The ultimate goal of any therapeutic program is for patients to heal themselves. Mom would never be one to live the unexamined life. Her desire for self-knowledge would lead her to seek counsel and companionship from like-minded souls all her life. It would also lead her to a new career, which is what really changed everything. One Sunday morning, not long after we arrived in town, Dad preached a sermon that happened to work in a reference to a magazine story he'd seen. A parishioner paused on the way out to shake his hand. Never heard a Knox minister talk about Red Book before, he cracked. His name was Keith Cooper. He was the superintendent of Rolling River School Division, covering a district just north of Brandon, with a progressive approach that belied its rural location. The Coopers would become lifelong family friends. It would be Keith who opened the door to Mum's new career. Keith was looking for a guidance counselor for a small-town high school, someone who would not frighten the rural superintendents, no sensitive college long-hairs freshly graduated and eager to shape young minds with the latest innovative strategies. The better Keith got to know Joan Burgess, the more convinced he was that she would be a perfect candidate. A quiet, 40-ish mother of 5 would not frighten any of the appointed burghers whose approval was required. More crucially, it seemed to Keith that Joan was made for the job. Empathetic, a listener rather than a talker, possessed of insight, compassion, and plenty of first-hand experience with kids. She was also a veteran of human relations and leadership seminars. My parents were big on those, going back to their days teaching Sunday school together in Regina. And perhaps best of all, Joan Burgess had a low threshold for nonsense. Once at Knox, Dad and his assistant came up with what they thought was a brilliant idea, a wrong way seminar. When participants, including Mom, arrived, the room was a mess. The stated goal was impossibly vague, the language impenetrable, the leader's behavior arrogant. Their clever plan was to do everything wrong and then evaluate the results. Most of the participants were confused, but Mum was enraged. When we got home, there was an explosion, Dad says. She thought it had been a betrayal, a denial of everything we stood for, dishonest, manipulative, and cruel. Compassionate, yet intolerant of bullshit. Perfect qualities for dealing with high school students. Keith Cooper told Joan that if she were to return to school for another year to get her teaching certificate, he could guarantee her a job when she graduated. So it would turn out. Our mom became a student at Brandon University. She graduated with her teaching certificate in 1968. In the fall of 1969, Joan Burgess began commuting 26 miles every day to Rivers, a farming town of fewer than 2,000 inhabitants, where she was the guidance counselor at the grandly named Rivers Collegiate Institute. Later, she would begin teaching English classes. She was good at it. Mom's new career had some practical implications at home. Two incomes meant the arrival of stuff. A microwave oven, for instance, a major signpost of early 70s prosperity. It was now possible for us to melt cheese over a piece of bread, even while that bread sat on a plain, miraculously unsinged paper plate. Men landing on the moon was impressive too, but it didn't have the same immediate impact. A little something else came our way around that time. A home. A real house, owned and operated by the Burgess family, located at 54 Clement Drive. It was a relatively new, ranch-style place with a deceptively large amount of floor space and a big finished basement. There was a crabapple tree in the backyard, and the apples weren't even sour. We all took to the house immediately. It had some very cool oddities, like a shower room in the basement, only one nozzle, but in a full-sized room with a tile floor. Very decadent. In later years, it would prove particularly useful when someone, say Leslie's friend Cindy, would drink too much and throw up on herself. You could just drag her into the shower room and turn on the tap. No one loved the house more than Mum, for whom 54 Clement meant a kind of freedom many women would never understand. Living in church housing had been perfectly okay for the kids. It was a constant nettle to Mum. Her simplest domestic decisions could always be overruled by that board of penny-pinching tyrants, the Manse Committee. Now, all that was over. Death to tyrants! Hello, interior design. A new home with a microwave and a ridiculously large shower and rooms of freedom. The benefits of our new double-income reality were there to be enjoyed. And there was another, less tangible effect. It was the slow cumulative influence of example. Mum and Dad both had real careers and clearly made family decisions together. There were no vetoes. As the 70s progressed, the ideals of feminism were being asserted with increasing force in public debate, but there was no debate at 54 Clement. Equality of the sexes was second nature at our place. We experienced it every day. Meanwhile, Dad's career at Knox United made him a natural community leader. In the early 70s, he was given an honorary appointment to the Brandon University Board of Governors. Other local luminaries on the board included MP Walter Dinsdale. The appointment was a sign of respect. It would also demonstrate the dark adage that no good deed goes unpunished. One day, in early 1972, there was a Board of Governors meeting. The regular chairman being absent, Dad took the chair. Among the issues voted upon was the installation of condom vending machines on the university campus. The vote was 7-2 in favor. Dinsdale voted no, and he was not prepared to let it go. Walter Dinsdale was first elected to Parliament in 1951. He would remain cemented to the Brandon Souris seat until his death 31 years later. Dinsdale's name rarely appeared in Hansard, the parliamentary record. For that, it's necessary to stand up and speak. But he knew his constituents. He knew that beyond the boardroom of Brandon University, folks weren't likely to be quite so progressively inclined as the good governors. So, shortly after the vote, Dinsdale recruited a teenager to go buy a condom from the new machine. Success. Condom in hand, the MP then alerted the media. A popular Winnipeg radio talk show host was soon trumpeting the news that Brandon University had begun teaching its host community how sexual morality is for suckers. Worst of all, was said, this corruption of local youth had begun with a Board of Governors vote, chaired by one William Burgess, a local United Church minister. The Knox congregation split. Pro and anti-Burgess camps neatly described the odd nature of both Brandon and the local United Church community, a mixture that ranged from retired farm folk to young academics. it threatened to become a battle for the soul of the congregation itself, with Dad's supporters eager for him to stick it out and battle the reactionaries. The local paper filled with angry letters. Our phone would ring late at night. I remember one call. A man asked for my dad, who was out. The caller then requested I inform Dad that he was a dirty old man, and hung up. I passed it along. One evening, Dad was meeting with two other local United Church ministers to plan an upcoming Easter service. Instead, he broke down and wept. "What the hell," one of the ministers said. "We've got an organist who's always asking to play Bach. She'll be happy to get the chance." The planning meeting gave way to a therapy session as Dad unloaded his grief about what was coming. He often said that he was never more grateful for an act of friendship. Dad had no stomach to tear his church apart. To considerable disappointment and some bitterness from his would-be ideological militia, he resigned from Knox United, a career that had begun with a doctorate in ministry and subsequently carried our family across four provinces and the state of Ohio, was finished. Dad would be unemployed for months. His next job would be in the Department of Agriculture. It was a twist of fate that made Mum's career more important than ever. 1972 was not exactly a spice garden for the family. No doubt we spent our days preoccupied with the issues and dramas of the day, but a moment of reflection taken that year would have paid dividends. Mum had turned the corner. She had a career, and our family had a new dynamic. For his part, Dad, a man born in 1925 and married in 1950, had awakened to the changing nature of his marriage and his world. His perspective had been widened, with a crowbar more or less, but it did happen. Their relationship had undergone the sort of transformation frequently associated with divorce. Faced with the level of unhappiness and dissatisfaction Mum had been experiencing, most people would throw it all away and start fresh. Many years later, she told me that either because of the times, the circumstances, or the individuals, divorce just wasn't an option. "With five kids," she said, "it was just something we wouldn't consider. You just didn't do it."